angst with a psychotherapist. Garbage. All I've been thinking about all week is garbage. I can't stop thinking about it. I've gotten real concerned over what's going to happen with all the garbage. I mean, we've got so much of it, you know? I mean, we have to run out of places to put this stuff eventually. The last time I started feeling this way is when that barge was stranded and, you know, it was going around the island and nobody would claim it. That barge refers to a 1987 media frenzy over a barge filled with 3,000 tons of New York garbage that was turned away by landfills up and down the Atlantic coast. The therapy scene is by no means fanciful, an experiment in which people watched news stories that had been doctored to have a positive or negative spin found that participants who watched the negatively valenced bulletin showed increases in both anxious and sad mood, and also showed a significant increase in the tendency to catastrophize a personal worry. 3 decades later, I suspect that many therapists are listening to patients sharing their fears about terrorism, income inequality, and climate change. A bit of anxiety is not a bad thing if it motivates people to support policies that would help solve major problems. In earlier decades, people might have offloaded their worries to a higher authority, and some still do. In 2000, 60 religious leaders endorsed the Cornwall Declaration on Environmental Stewardship, which addressed the so-called climate crisis and other environmental problems by affirming that God in His mercy has not abandoned sinful people or the created order, but has acted throughout history to restore men and women to fellowship with Him, and through their stewardship to enhance the beauty and fertility of the earth. I imagine that they and the other 1,500 signatories do not visit therapists to air anxieties about the future of the planet. But as George Bernard Shaw observed, the fact that a believer is happier than a skeptic is no more to the point than the fact that a drunken man is happier than a sober one. Though some amount of anxiety will inevitably attend the contemplation of our political and existential conundrums, it need not drive us to pathology or despair. One of the challenges of modernity is how to grapple with a growing portfolio of responsibilities without worrying ourselves to death. As with all new challenges, we are groping toward the right mixture of old-fashioned and novel stratagems, including human contact, art, meditation, cognitive behavioral therapy, mindfulness, small pleasures, judicious use of pharmaceuticals, reinvigorated service and social organizations, and advice from wise people on how to lead a balanced life. The media and commentariat, for their part, could reflect on their own role in keeping the country's anxiety at a boil. The trash barge story is emblematic of the media's anxiogenic practices. Lost in the coverage at the time was the fact that the barge was forced on its peregrination not by a shortage of landfill space, but by paperwork errors and the media frenzy itself. In the decades since, there have been few follow-ups that debunk misconceptions about a solid waste crisis. The country actually has plenty of landfills, and they are environmentally sound. Not every problem is a crisis, a plague, or an epidemic, and among the things that happen in the world is that people solve the problems confronting them. And speaking of panics, what do you think are the greatest threats to the human species? In the 1960s, several thinkers advised that they were overpopulation, nuclear war, and boredom. One scientist warned that, although the first two might be survivable, the third definitely was not. Boredom? Really? You see, as people no longer have to work all day and think about where their next meal is coming from, they will be at a loss as to how to fill their waking hours, and will be vulnerable to debauchery, insanity, suicide, and the sway of religious and political fanatics. 50 years later, it seems to me that we have solved the boredom crisis, or was it an epidemic, and are instead experiencing the apocryphal Chinese curse of living in interesting times. But don't take my word for it. Since 1973, the General Social Survey has asked Americans whether they find life exciting, routine, or dull. Figure 18-4 shows that over the decades in which fewer Americans said they were very happy, more of them said that life is exciting. The divergence of the curves is not a paradox. Recall that people who feel they lead meaningful lives are more susceptible to stress, struggle, and worry. Consider as well that anxiety has always been a perquisite of adulthood. It rises steeply from the school-age years to the early 20s as people take on adult responsibilities, and then falls steadily over the rest of the life course as they learn to cope with them. Perhaps that is emblematic of the challenges of modernity. Though people today are happier, they are not as happy as one might expect. Perhaps because they have an adult's appreciation of life with all its worry and all its excitement. The original definition of enlightenment, after all, was humankind's emergence from its self-incurred immaturity. Chapter 19. Existential Threats. But are we flirting with disaster? When pessimists are forced to concede that life has been getting better and better for more and more people, they have a retort at the ready. We are cheerfully hurtling toward a catastrophe, they say, like the man who fell off the roof and says, "So far, so good," as he passes each floor. Or we are playing Russian roulette, and the deadly odds are bound to catch up to us. Or we will be blindsided by a black swan, a four sigma event far along the tail of the statistical distribution of hazards with low odds but calamitous harm. For half a century, the four horsemen of the modern apocalypse have been overpopulation, resource shortages, pollution, and nuclear war. They have recently been joined by a cavalry of more exotic knights, nanobots that will engulf us, robots that will enslave us, artificial intelligence that will turn us into raw materials, and Bulgarian teenagers who will brew a genocidal virus or take down the internet from their bedrooms. The sentinels for the familiar horsemen tended to be romantics and Luddites, but those who warn of the higher tech dangers are often scientists and technologists who have deployed their ingenuity to identify ever more ways in which the world will soon end. In 2003, the eminent astrophysicist Martin Rees published a book entitled Our Final Hour, in which he warned that humankind is potentially the maker of its own demise, and laid out some dozen ways in which we have endangered the future of the entire universe. For example, experiments in particle colliders could create a black hole that would annihilate the Earth, or a strangelet of compressed quarks that would cause all matter in the cosmos to bind to it and disappear. Rees tapped a rich vein of catastrophism. The book's Amazon page notes, "Customers who viewed this item also viewed global catastrophic risks, our final invention, artificial intelligence, and the end of the human era, the end, what science and religion tell us about the apocalypse, and World War Z, an oral history of the zombie war." Techno-philanthropists have bankrolled research institutes dedicated to discovering new existential threats and figuring out how to save the world from them, including the Future of Humanity Institute, the Future of Life Institute, the Center for the Study of Existential Risk, and the Global Catastrophic Risk Institute. How should we think about the existential threats that lurk behind our incremental progress? No one can prophesy that a cataclysm will never happen, and this chapter contains no such assurance. But I will lay out a way to think about them and examine the major menaces. Three of the threats, overpopulation, resource depletion, and pollution, including greenhouse gases, were discussed in Chapter 10, and I will take the same approach here. Some threats are figments of cultural and historical pessimism. Others are genuine, but we can treat them not as apocalypses in waiting, but as problems to be solved. At first glance, one might think that the more thought we give to existential risks, the better. The stakes quite literally could not be higher. What harm could there be in getting people to think about these terrible risks? The worst that could happen is that we would take some precautions that turn out in retrospect to have been unnecessary. But apocalyptic thinking has serious downsides. One is that false alarms to catastrophic risks can themselves be catastrophic. The nuclear arms race of the 1960s, for example, was set off by fears of a mythical missile gap with the Soviet Union. The 2003 invasion of Iraq was justified by the uncertain but catastrophic possibility that Saddam Hussein was developing nuclear weapons and planning to use them against the United States. As George W. Bush put it, "We cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun, that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud." And as we shall see, one of the reasons the great powers refuse to take the common-sense pledge that they won't be the first to use nuclear weapons is that they want to reserve the right to use them against other supposed existential threats, such as bioterror and cyber attacks. Sowing fear about hypothetical disasters, far from safeguarding the future of humanity, can endanger it. A second hazard of enumerating doomsday scenarios is that humanity has a finite budget of resources, brain power, and anxiety. You can't worry about everything. Some of the threats facing us, like climate change and nuclear war, are unmistakable and will require immense effort and ingenuity to mitigate. Folding them into a list of exotic scenarios with minuscule or unknown probabilities can only dilute the sense of urgency. Recall that people are poor at assessing probabilities, especially small ones, and instead play out scenarios in their mind's eye. If two scenarios are equally imaginable, they may be considered equally probable, and people will worry about the genuine hazard no more than about the science fiction plot line. And the more ways people can imagine bad things happening, the higher their estimate that something bad will happen. And that leads to the greatest danger of all, that people will think, as a recent New York Times article put it, "These grim facts should lead any reasonable person to conclude that humanity is screwed." If humanity is screwed, why sacrifice anything to reduce potential risks? Why forego the convenience of fossil fuels or exhort governments to rethink their nuclear weapons policies? Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. A 2013 survey in four English-speaking countries showed that among the respondents who believe that our way of life will probably end in a century, a majority endorsed the statement, "The world's future looks grim, so we have to focus on looking after ourselves and those we love." Few writers on technological risk give much thought to the cumulative psychological effects of the drumbeat of doom. As Ellen Kelsey, an environmental communicator, points out, "We have media ratings to protect children from sex or violence in movies, but we think nothing of inviting a scientist into a second-grade classroom and telling the kids the planet is ruined." A quarter of Australian children are so troubled about the state of the world that they honestly believe it will come to an end before they get older. According to recent polls, so do 15% of people worldwide, and between a quarter and a third of Americans. In The Progress Paradox, the journalist Greg Easterbrook suggests that a major reason that Americans are not happier, despite their rising objective fortunes, is collapse anxiety, the fear that civilization may implode and there's nothing anyone can do about it. Of course, people's emotions are irrelevant if the risks are real. But risk assessments fall apart when they deal with highly improbable events in complex systems. Since we cannot replay history thousands of times and count the outcomes, a statement that some event will occur with a probability of 0.01 or 0.001 or 0.0001 or 0.00001 is essentially a readout of the assessor's subjective confidence. This includes mathematical analyses in which scientists plot the distribution of events in the past, like wars or cyber attacks, and show they fall into a power law distribution, one with fat or thick tails, in which extreme events are highly improbable but not astronomically improbable. The math is of little help in calibrating the risk because the scattershot data along the tail of the distribution generally misbehave, deviating from a smooth curve and making estimation impossible. All we know is that very bad things can happen. That takes us back to subjective readouts, which tend to be inflated by the availability and negativity biases and by the gravitas market, Chapter 4. Those who sow fear about a dreadful prophecy may be seen as serious and responsible, while those who are measured are seen as complacent and naive. Despair springs eternal. At least since the Hebrew prophets and the Book of Revelation, seers have warned their contemporaries about an imminent doomsday. Forecasts of end times are a staple of psychics, mystics, televangelists, nut cults, founders of religions, and men pacing the sidewalk with sandwich boards saying, "Repent." The storyline that climaxes in harsh payback for technological hubris is an archetype of Western fiction, including Promethean Fire, Pandora's Box, Icarus's Flight, Faust's Bargain, The Sorcerer's Apprentice, Frankenstein's Monster, and, from Hollywood, more than 250 end-of-the-world flicks. As the engineer Eric Zensi has observed, there is seduction in apocalyptic thinking. If one lives in the last days, one's actions, one's very life, take on historical meaning, and no small measure of poignance. Scientists and technologists are by no means immune. Remember the Y2K bug? In the 1990s, as the turn of the millennium drew near, computer scientists began to warn the world of an impending catastrophe. In the early decades of computing, when information was expensive, programmers often saved a couple of bytes by representing a year by its last two digits. They figured that by the time the year 2000 came around, and the implicit 19 was no longer valid, the programs would be long obsolete. But complicated software is replaced slowly, and many old programs were still running on institutional mainframes and embedded in chips. When 12 a.m. on January 1st, 2000 arrived, and the digits rolled over, a program would think it was 1900 and would crash or go haywire, presumably because it would divide some number by the difference between what it thought was the current year and the year 1900, namely zero, though why a program would do this was never made clear. At that moment, bank balances would be wiped out, elevators would stop between floors, incubators in maternity wards would shut off, water pumps would freeze, planes would fall from the sky, nuclear power plants would melt down, and ICBMs would be launched from their silos. And these were the hard-headed predictions from tech-savvy authorities, such as President Bill Clinton, who warned the nation, "I want to stress the urgency of the challenge. This is not one of the summer movies where you can close your eyes during the scary part." Cultural pessimists saw the Y2K bug as comeuppance for enthralling our civilization to technology. Among religious thinkers, the numerological link to Christian millennialism was irresistible. The Reverend Jerry Falwell declared, "I believe that Y2K may be God's instrument to shake this nation, humble this nation, awaken this nation, and from this nation start revival that spreads the face of the earth before the rapture of the church." $100 billion was spent worldwide on reprogramming software for Y2K readiness, a challenge that was likened to replacing every bolt in every bridge in the world. As a former assembly language programmer, I was skeptical of the doomsday scenarios, and fortuitously I was in New Zealand, the first country to welcome the new millennium, at the fateful moment. Sure enough, at 12 a.m. on January 1st, nothing happened, as I quickly reassured family members back home on a fully functioning telephone. The Y2K reprogrammers, like the elephant repellent salesman, took credit for averting disaster, but many countries and small businesses had taken their chances without any Y2K preparation, and they had no problems either. Though some software needed updating, one program on my laptop displayed January 1st, 19,100, it turned out that very few programs, particularly those embedded in machines, had both contained the bug and performed furious arithmetic on the current year. The threat turned out to be barely more serious than the lettering on the sidewalk prophet's sandwich board. The great Y2K panic does not mean that all warnings of potential catastrophes are false alarms, but it reminds us that we are vulnerable to techno-apocalyptic delusions. How should we think about catastrophic threats? Let's begin with the greatest existential question of all, the fate of our species. As with the more parochial question of our fate as individuals, we assuredly have to come to terms with our mortality. Biologists joke that to a first approximation, all species are extinct, since that was the fate of at least 99% of the species that ever lived. A typical mammalian species lasts around 1 million years, and it's hard to insist that Homo sapiens will be an exception. Even if we had remained technologically humble hunter-gatherers, we would still be living in a geological shooting gallery. A burst of gamma rays from a supernova or collapsed star could irradiate half the planet, brown the atmosphere, and destroy the ozone layer, allowing ultraviolet light to irradiate the other half. Or the Earth's magnetic field could flip, exposing the planet to an interlude of lethal solar and cosmic radiation. An asteroid could slam into the Earth, flattening thousands of square miles and kicking up debris that would black out the sun and drench us with corrosive rain. Supervolcanoes or massive lava flows could choke us with ash, CO2, and sulfuric acid. A black hole could wander into the solar system and pull the Earth out of its orbit or suck it into oblivion. Even if the species manages to survive for 1 billion more years, the Earth and solar system will not. The sun will start to use up its hydrogen, become denser and hotter, and boil away our oceans on its way to becoming a red giant. Technology, then, is not the reason that our species must someday face the Grim Reaper. Indeed, technology is our best hope for cheating death, at least for a while. As long as we are entertaining hypothetical disasters far in the future, we must also ponder hypothetical advances that would allow us to survive them, such as growing food under lights powered with nuclear fusion, or synthesizing it in industrial plants like biofuel. Even technologies of the not-so-distant future could save our skin. It's technically feasible to track the trajectories of asteroids and other extinction-class near-Earth objects, spot the ones that are on a collision course with the Earth, and nudge them off course before they send us the way of the dinosaurs. NASA has also figured out a way to pump water at high pressure into a supervolcano and extract the heat for geothermal energy, cooling the magma enough that it would never blow its top. Our ancestors were powerless to stop these lethal menaces, so in that sense, technology has not made this a uniquely dangerous era in the history of our species, but a uniquely safe one. For this reason, the techno-apocalyptic claim that ours is the first civilization that can destroy itself is misconceived. As Ozymandias reminds the traveler in Percy Bysshe Shelley's poem, most of the civilizations that have ever existed have been destroyed. Conventional history blames the destruction on external events like plagues, conquests, earthquakes, or weather. But David Deutsch points out that those civilizations could have thwarted the fatal blows had they had better agricultural, medical, or military technology. Before our ancestors learned how to make fire artificially, and many times since then, too, people must have died of exposure literally on top of the means of making the fires that would have saved their lives, because they did not know how. In a parochial sense, the weather killed them. But the deeper explanation is lack of knowledge. Many of the hundreds of millions of victims of cholera throughout history must have died within sight of the hearths that could have boiled their drinking water and saved their lives. But again, they did not know that. Quite generally, the distinction between a natural disaster and one brought about by ignorance is parochial. Prior to every natural disaster that people once used to think of as just happening, or being ordained by gods, we now see many options that the people affected failed to take, or rather to create. And all those options add up to the overarching option that they failed to create, namely that of forming a scientific and technological civilization like ours. Traditions of criticism and enlightenment. Prominent among the existential risks that supposedly threatened the future of humanity is a 21st century version of the Y2K bug. This is the danger that we will be subjugated, intentionally or accidentally, by artificial intelligence, AI, a disaster sometimes called the Robopocalypse, and commonly illustrated with stills from the Terminator movies. As with Y2K, some smart people take it seriously. Elon Musk, whose company makes artificially intelligent self-driving cars, called the technology more dangerous than nukes. Stephen Hawking, speaking through his artificially intelligent synthesizer, warned that it could spell the end of the human race. But among the smart people who aren't losing sleep are most experts in artificial intelligence and most experts in human intelligence. The Robopocalypse is based on a muzzy conception of intelligence that owes more to the great chain of being and a Nietzschean will to power than to a modern scientific understanding. In this conception, intelligence is an all-powerful, wish-granting potion that agents possess in different amounts. Humans have more of it than animals, and an artificially intelligent computer or robot of the future, an AI in the new count-noun usage, will have more of it than humans. Since we humans have used our moderate endowment to domesticate or exterminate less well-endowed animals, and since technologically advanced societies have enslaved or annihilated technologically primitive ones, it follows that a supersmart AI would do the same to us. Since an AI will think millions of times faster than we do, and use its superintelligence to recursively improve its superintelligence, a scenario sometimes called FOOM, after the comic book sound effect, from the instant it is turned on, we will be powerless to stop it. But the scenario makes about as much sense as the worry that since jet planes have surpassed the flying ability of eagles, someday they will swoop out of the sky and seize our cattle. The first fallacy is a confusion of intelligence with motivation, of beliefs with desires, inferences with goals, thinking with wanting. Even if we did invent superhumanly intelligent robots, why would they want to enslave their masters or take over the world? Intelligence is the ability to deploy novel means to attain a goal, but the goals are extraneous to the intelligence. Being smart is not the same as wanting something. It just so happens that the intelligence in one system, Homo sapiens, is a product of Darwinian natural selection, an inherently competitive process. In the brains of that species, reasoning comes bundled, to varying degrees in different specimens, with goals such as dominating rivals and amassing resources. But it's a mistake to confuse a circuit in the limbic brain of a certain species of primate with the very nature of intelligence. An artificially intelligent system that was designed rather than evolved could just as easily think like schmooze, the blobby altruists in Al Capp's comic strip Lil Abner, who deploy their considerable ingenuity to barbecue themselves for the benefit of human eaters. There is no law of complex systems that says that intelligent agents must turn into ruthless conquistadors. Indeed, we know of one highly advanced form of intelligence that evolved without this defect. They're called women. The second fallacy is to think of intelligence as a boundless continuum of potency, a miraculous elixir with the power to solve any problem, attain any goal. The fallacy leads to nonsensical questions like when an AI will exceed human-level intelligence, and to the image of an ultimate artificial general intelligence, AGI, with godlike omniscience and omnipotence. Intelligence is a contraption of gadgets, software modules that acquire, or are programmed with, knowledge of how to pursue various goals in various domains. People are equipped to find food, win friends and influence people, charm prospective mates, bring up children, move around in the world, and pursue other human obsessions and pastimes. Computers may be programmed to take on some of these problems, like recognizing faces, not to bother with others, like charming mates, and to take on still other problems that humans can't solve, like simulating the climate or sorting millions of accounting records. The problems are different, and the kinds of knowledge needed to solve them are different. Unlike Laplace's demon, the mythical being that knows the location and momentum of every particle in the universe and feeds them into equations for physical laws to calculate the state of everything at any time in the future, a real life knower has to acquire information about the messy world of objects and people by engaging with it one domain at a time. Understanding does not obey Moore's law. Knowledge is acquired by formulating explanations and testing them against reality, not by running an algorithm faster and faster. Devouring the information on the Internet will not confer omniscience either. Big data is still finite data, and the universe of knowledge is infinite. For these reasons, many AI researchers are annoyed by the latest round of hype, the perennial bane of AI, which has misled observers into thinking that artificial general intelligence is just around the corner. As far as I know, there are no projects to build an AGI. Not just because it would be commercially dubious, but because the concept is barely coherent. The 2010s have, to be sure, brought us systems that can drive cars, caption photographs, recognize speech, and beat humans at Jeopardy, Go, and Atari computer games. But the advances have not come from a better understanding of the workings of intelligence, but from the brute force power of faster chips and bigger data, which allow the programs to be trained on millions of examples and generalized to similar new ones. Each system is an idiot savant, with little ability to leap to problems it was not set up to solve, and a brittle mastery of those it was. A photo captioning program labels an impending plane crash, an airplane is parked on the tarmac. A game-playing program is flummoxed by the slightest change in the scoring rules. Though the programs will surely get better, there are no signs of foom. Nor have any of these programs made a move toward taking over the lab or enslaving their programmers. Even if an AGI tried to exercise a will to power, without the cooperation of humans, it would remain an impotent brain in a vat. The computer scientist Ramez Nam deflates the bubbles surrounding foom, a technological singularity and exponential self-improvement. Imagine that you are a superintelligent AI running on some sort of microprocessor, or perhaps millions of such microprocessors. In an instant, you come up with a design for an even faster, more powerful microprocessor you can run on. Now, tracked. You have to actually manufacture those microprocessors. And those fabs, fabrication plants, take tremendous energy. They take the input of materials imported from all around the world. They take highly controlled internal environments which require airlocks, filters, and all sorts of specialized equipment to maintain and so on. All of this takes time and energy to acquire, transport, integrate, build housing for, build power plants for, test and manufacture. The real world has gotten in the way of your upward spiral of self-transcendence. The real world gets in the way of many digital apocalypses. When Hal gets uppity, Dave disables it with a screwdriver, leaving it pathetically singing "A Bicycle Built for Two" to itself. Of course, one can always imagine a doomsday computer that is malevolent, universally empowered, always on, and tamper-proof. The way to deal with this threat is straightforward. Don't build one. As the prospect of evil robots started to seem too kitschy to take seriously, a new digital apocalypse was spotted by the existential guardians. This storyline is based not on Frankenstein or the Golem, but on the genie granting us three wishes, the third of which is needed to undo the first two, and on King Midas ruining his ability to turn everything he touched into gold, including his food and his family. The danger, sometimes called the value alignment problem, is that we might give an AI a goal and then helplessly stand by as it relentlessly and literal-mindedly implemented its interpretation of that goal. The rest of our interests be damned. If we gave an AI the goal of maintaining the water level behind a dam, it might flood a town, not caring about the people who drowned. If we gave it the goal of making paperclips, it might turn all the matter in the reachable universe into paperclips, including our possessions and bodies. If we asked it to maximize human happiness, it might implant us all with intravenous dopamine drips, or rewire our brains so we were happiest sitting in jars. Or, if it had been trained on the concept of happiness with pictures of smiling faces, tile the galaxy with trillions of nanoscopic pictures of smiley faces. I'm not making these up. These are the scenarios that supposedly illustrate the existential threat to the human species of advanced artificial intelligence. They are, fortunately, self-refuting. They depend on the premises that, one, humans are so gifted that they can design an omniscient and omnipotent AI, yet so moronic that they would give it control of the universe without testing how it works, and two, the AI would be so brilliant that it could figure out how to transmute elements and rewire brains, yet so imbecilic that it would wreak havoc based on elementary blunders of misunderstanding. The ability to choose an action that best satisfies conflicting goals is not an add-on to intelligence that engineers might slap themselves in the forehead for forgetting to install. It is intelligence. So is the ability to interpret the intentions of a language user in context. Only in a television comedy like Get Smart does a robot respond to grab the waiter by hefting the maitre d' over his head, or kill the light by pulling out a pistol and shooting it. When we put aside fantasies like Foom, digital megalomania, instant omniscience, and perfect control of every molecule in the universe, artificial intelligence is like any other technology. It is developed incrementally, designed to satisfy multiple conditions, tested before it is implemented, and constantly tweaked for efficacy and safety. Chapter 12. As the AI expert Stuart Russell puts it, no one in civil engineering talks about building bridges that don't fall down. They just call it building bridges. Likewise, he notes, AI that is beneficial rather than dangerous is simply AI. Artificial intelligence, to be sure, poses the more mundane challenge of what to do about the people whose jobs are eliminated by automation. But the jobs won't be eliminated that quickly. The observation of a 1965 report from NASA still holds. Man is the lowest-cost, 150-pound, non-linear, all-purpose computer system which can be mass-produced by unskilled labor. Driving a car is an easier engineering problem than unloading a dishwasher, running an errand, or changing a diaper. And at the time of this writing, we're still not ready to loose self-driving cars on city streets. Until the day when battalions of robots are inoculating children and building schools in the developing world, or for that matter, building infrastructure and caring for the aged in ours, there will be plenty of work to be done. The same kind of ingenuity that has been applied to the design of software and robots could be applied to the design of government and private sector policies that match idle hands with undone work. If not robots, then what about hackers? We all know the stereotypes. Bulgarian teenagers, young men wearing flip-flops and drinking Red Bull, and as Donald Trump put it in a 2016 presidential debate, somebody sitting on their bed that weighs 400 pounds. According to a common line of thinking, as technology advances, the destructive power available to an individual will multiply. It's only a matter of time before a single nerd or terrorist builds a nuclear bomb in his garage, or genetically engineers a plague virus, or takes down the internet. And with the modern world so dependent on technology, an outage could bring on panic, starvation, and anarchy. In 2002, Martin Rees publicly offered the bet that by 2020, bioterror or bioerror will lead to 1 million casualties in a single event. How should we think about these nightmares? Sometimes they are intended to get people to take security vulnerabilities more seriously, under the theory, which we will encounter again in this chapter, that the most effective way to mobilize people into adopting responsible policies is to scare the living daylights out of them. Whether or not that theory is true, no one would argue that we should be complacent about cybercrime or disease outbreaks, which are already afflictions of the modern world. I'll turn to the nuclear threat in the next section. Specialists in computer security and epidemiology constantly try to stay one step ahead of these threats, and countries should clearly invest in both. Military, financial, energy, and internet infrastructure should be made more secure and resilient. Treaties and safeguards against biological weapons can be strengthened. Transnational public health networks, that can identify and contain outbreaks before they become pandemics should be expanded. Together with better vaccines, antibiotics, antivirals, and rapid diagnostic tests, they will be as useful in combating human-made pathogens as natural ones. Countries will also need to maintain anti-terrorist and crime prevention measures such as surveillance and interception. In each of these arms races, the defense will never, of course, be invincible. There may be episodes of cyberterrorism and bioterrorism, and the probability of a catastrophe will never be zero. The question I'll consider is whether the grim facts should lead any reasonable person to conclude that humanity is screwed. Is it inevitable that the black hats will someday outsmart the white hats and bring civilization to its knees? Has technological progress ironically left the world newly fragile? No one can know with certainty. But when we replace worst-case dread with calmer consideration, the gloom starts to lift. Let's start with the historical sweep. Whether mass destruction by an individual is a natural outcome of the process set in motion by the scientific revolution and the Enlightenment. According to this narrative, technology allows people to accomplish more and more with less and less. So given enough time, it will allow one individual to do anything. And given human nature, that means destroy everything. But Kevin Kelly, the founding editor of Wired magazine and author of What Technology Wants, argues that this is, in fact, not the way technology progresses. Kelly was the co-organizer, with Stuart Brandt, of the first Hackers Conference in 1984, and since that time he has repeatedly been told that any day now technology will outrun humans' ability to domesticate it. Yet despite the massive expansion of technology in those decades, including the invention of the Internet, that has not happened. Kelly suggests that there is a reason. The more powerful technologies become, the more socially embedded they become. Cutting-edge technology requires a network of cooperators who are connected to still wider social networks, many of them committed to keeping people safe from technology and from each other. As we saw in Chapter 12, technologies get safer over time. This undermines the Hollywood cliché of the solitary evil genius who commands a high-tech lair in which the technology miraculously works by itself. Kelly suggests that because of the social embeddedness of technology, the destructive power of a solitary individual has in fact not increased over time. The more sophisticated and powerful a technology, the more people are needed to weaponize it. And the more people needed to weaponize it, the more societal controls work to diffuse or soften or prevent harm from happening. I add one additional thought. Even if you had a budget to hire a team of scientists whose job it was to develop a species-extinguishing bioweapon, or to take down the Internet to zero, you probably still couldn't do it. That's because hundreds of thousands of man-years of effort have gone into preventing this from happening, in the case of the Internet, and millions of years of evolutionary effort to prevent species death, in the case of biology. It is extremely hard to do. And the smaller the rogue team, the harder. The larger the team, the more societal influences. All this is abstract. One theory of the natural arc of technology versus another. How does it apply to the actual dangers we face so that we can ponder whether humanity is screwed? The key is not to fall for the availability bias and assume that if we can imagine something terrible, it is bound to happen. The real danger depends on the numbers, the proportion of people who want to cause mayhem or mass murder, the proportion of that genocidal sliver with the competence to concoct an effective cyber or biological weapon, the sliver of that sliver whose schemes will actually succeed, and the sliver of the sliver of the sliver that accomplishes a civilization-ending cataclysm rather than a nuisance, a blow, or even a disaster, after which life goes on. Start with the number of maniacs. Does the modern world harbor a significant number of people who want to visit murder and mayhem on strangers? If it did, life would be unrecognizable. They could go on stabbing rampages, spray gunfire into crowds, mow down pedestrians with cars, set off pressure cooker bombs, and shove people off sidewalks and subway platforms into the path of hurtling vehicles. The researcher Gwern Bronwyn has calculated that a disciplined sniper or serial killer could murder hundreds of people without getting caught. A saboteur with a thirst for havoc could tamper with supermarket products, lace some pesticide into a feedlot or water supply, or even just make an anonymous call claiming to have done so, and it could cost a company hundreds of millions of dollars in recalls, and a country billions in lost exports. Such attacks could take place in every city in the world many times a day, but in fact take place somewhere or other every few years, leading the security expert Bruce Schneier to ask, "Where are all the terrorist attacks?" Despite all the terror generated by terrorism, there must be very few individuals out there waiting for an opportunity to wreak wanton destruction. Among these depraved individuals, how large is the subset with the intelligence and discipline to develop an effective cyber or bioweapon? Far from being criminal masterminds, most terrorists are bumbling schlemiels. Typical specimens include the shoe bomber, who unsuccessfully tried to down an airliner by igniting explosives in his shoe, the underwear bomber, who unsuccessfully tried to down an airliner by detonating explosives in his underwear, the ISIS trainer who demonstrated an explosive vest to his class of aspiring suicide terrorists and blew himself and all 21 of them to bits. The Tsarnaev brothers, who followed up on their bombing of the Boston Marathon by murdering a police officer in an unsuccessful attempt to steal his gun, and then embarked on a carjacking, a robbery, and a Hollywood-style car chase during which one brother ran over the other, and Abdullah al-Asiri, who tried to assassinate a Saudi deputy minister with an improvised explosive device hidden in his anus, and succeeded only in obliterating himself. An intelligence analysis firm reported that the event signals a paradigm shift in suicide bombing tactics. Occasionally, as on September 11, 2001, a team of clever and disciplined terrorists gets lucky, but most successful plots are low-tech attacks on target-rich gatherings and, as we saw in Chapter 13, kill very few people. Indeed, I venture that the proportion of brilliant terrorists in a population is even smaller than the proportion of terrorists multiplied by the proportion of brilliant people. Terrorism is a demonstrably ineffective tactic, and a mind that delights in senseless mayhem for its own sake is probably not the brightest bulb in the box. Now take the small number of brilliant weaponeers and cut it down still further by the proportion with the cunning and luck to outsmart the world's police, security experts, and counterterrorism forces. The number may not be zero, but it surely isn't high. As with all complex undertakings, many heads are better than one, and an organization of bio or cyber terrorists could be more effective than a lone mastermind. But that's where Kelly's observation kicks in. The leader would have to recruit and manage a team of co-conspirators who exercised perfect secrecy, competence, and loyalty to the depraved cause. As the size of the team increases, so do the odds of detection, betrayal, infiltrators, blunders, and stings. Serious threats to the integrity of a country's infrastructure are likely to require the resources of a state. Software hacking is not enough. The hacker needs detailed knowledge about the physical construction of the systems he hopes to sabotage. When the Iranian nuclear centrifuges were compromised in 2010 by the Stuxnet worm, it required a coordinated effort by two technologically sophisticated nations, the United States and Israel. State-based cyber sabotage escalates the malevolence from terrorism to a kind of warfare, where the constraints of international relations, such as norms, treaties, sanctions, retaliation, and military deterrence, inhibit aggressive attacks, as they do in conventional kinetic warfare. As we saw in Chapter 11, these constraints have become increasingly effective at preventing interstate war. Nonetheless, American military officials have warned of a digital Pearl Harbor and a cyber Armageddon, in which foreign states or sophisticated terrorist organizations would hack into American sites to crash planes, open floodgates, melt down nuclear power plants, black out power grids, and take down the financial system. Most cybersecurity experts consider the threats to be inflated, a pretext for more military funding, power, and restrictions on internet privacy and freedom. The reality is that so far, not a single person has ever been injured by a cyber attack. The strikes have mostly been nuisances such as doxing, namely leaking confidential documents or email, as in the Russian meddling in the 2016 American election, and distributed denial-of-service attacks where a botnet, an array of hacked computers, floods a site with traffic. Schneier explains, a real-world comparison might be if an army invaded a country, then all got in line in front of people at the Department of Motor Vehicles so they couldn't renew their licenses. If that's what war looks like in the 21st century, we have little to fear. For the techno-doomsters, though, tiny probabilities are no comfort. All it will take, they say, is for one hacker or terrorist or rogue state to get lucky, and it's game over. That's why the word threat is preceded with existential, giving the adjective its biggest workout since the heyday of Sartre and Camus. In 2001, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff warned that the biggest existential threat out there is cyber, prompting John Mueller to comment, as opposed to small existential threats, presumably. This existentialism depends on a casual slide from nuisance to adversity to tragedy to disaster to annihilation. Suppose there was an episode of bioterror, or bioterror that killed a million people. Suppose a hacker did manage to take down the internet. Would the country literally cease to exist? Would civilization collapse? Would the human species go extinct? A little proportion, please. Even Hiroshima continues to exist. The assumption is that modern people are so helpless that if the internet ever went down, farmers would stand by and watch their crops rot while dazed city dwellers starved. But disaster sociology, yes, there is such a field, has shown that people are highly resilient in the face of catastrophe. Far from looting, panicking, or sinking into paralysis, they spontaneously cooperate to restore order and improvise networks for distributing goods and services. Enrico Quarantelli noted that within minutes of the Hiroshima nuclear blast, survivors engaged in search and rescue, helped one another in whatever ways they could, and withdrew in controlled flight from burning areas. Within a day, apart from the planning undertaken by the government and military organizations that partly survived, other groups partially restored electric power to some areas. A steel company with 20% of workers attending began operations again. Employees of the 12 banks in Hiroshima assembled in the Hiroshima branch in the city and began making payments, and trolley lines leading into the city were completely cleared with partial traffic restored the following day. One reason that the death toll of World War II was so horrendous is that war planners on both sides adopted the strategy of bombing civilians until their societies collapsed, which they never did. And no, this resilience was not a relic of the homogeneous communities of yesteryear. Cosmopolitan 21st century societies can cope with disasters, too, as we saw in the orderly evacuation of Lower Manhattan following the 9/11 attacks in the United States and the absence of panic in Estonia in 2007, when the country was struck with a devastating denial-of-service cyber attack. Bioterrorism may be another phantom menace. Biological weapons renounced in a 1972 international convention by virtually every nation have played no role in modern warfare. The ban was driven by a widespread revulsion at the very idea, but the world's militaries needed little convincing because tiny living things make lousy weapons. They easily blow back and infect the weaponeers, warriors, and citizens of the side that uses them. Just imagine the Tsarnaev brothers with anthrax spores. And whether a disease outbreak fizzles out, or literally goes viral, depends on intricate network dynamics that even the best epidemiologists cannot predict. Biological agents are particularly ill-suited to terrorists, whose goal, recall, is not damage, but theater. Chapter 13. The biologist Paul Ewald notes that natural selection among pathogens works against the terrorist's goal of sudden and spectacular devastation. Germs that depend on rapid person-to-person contagion, like the common cold virus, are selected to keep their hosts alive and ambulatory so they can shake hands with and sneeze on as many people as possible. Germs get greedy and kill their hosts only if they have some other way of getting from body to body, like mosquitoes for malaria, a contaminable water supply for cholera, or trenches packed with injured soldiers for the 1918 Spanish flu. Sexually transmitted pathogens like HIV and syphilis are somewhere in between, needing a long and symptomless incubation period during which hosts can infect their partners, after which the germs do their damage. Virulence and contagion thus trade off, and the evolution of germs will frustrate the terrorist's aspiration to launch a headline-worthy epidemic that is both swift and lethal. Theoretically, a bioterrorist could try to bend the curve with a pathogen that is virulent, contagious, and durable enough to survive outside bodies. But breeding such a fine-tuned germ would require Nazi-like experiments on living humans that even terrorists, to say nothing of teenagers, are unlikely to carry off. It may be more than just luck that the world so far has seen just one successful bioterror attack, the 1984 tainting of salad with salmonella in an Oregon town by the Rajneeshi religious cult, which killed no one, and one spree killing, the 2001 anthrax mailings, which killed 5. To be sure, advances in synthetic biology, such as the gene editing technique CRISPR-Cas9, make it easier to tinker with organisms, including pathogens. But it's difficult to re-engineer a complex evolved trait by inserting a gene or two, since the effects of any gene are intertwined with the rest of the organism's genome. Ewald notes, "I don't think that we are close to understanding how to insert combinations of genetic variants in any given pathogen that act in concert to generate high transmissibility and stably high virulence for humans." The biotech expert Robert Carlson adds that, "One of the problems with building any flu virus is that you need to keep your production system, cells or eggs, alive long enough to make a useful quantity of something that is trying to kill that production system. Booting up the resulting virus is still very, very difficult. I would not dismiss this threat completely, but frankly, I am much more worried about what Mother Nature is throwing at us all the time." And crucially, advances in biology work the other way as well. They also make it easier for the good guys, and there are many more of them, to identify pathogens, invent antibiotics that overcome antibiotic resistance, and rapidly develop vaccines. An example is the Ebola vaccine, developed in the waning days of the 2014-2015 emergency, after public health efforts had capped the toll at 12,000 deaths rather than the millions that the media had foreseen. Ebola thus joined a list of other falsely predicted pandemics such as Lassa fever, hantavirus, SARS, mad cow disease, bird flu, and swine flu. Some of them never had the potential to go pandemic in the first place because they are contracted from animals of food rather than in an exponential tree of person-to-person infections. Others were nipped by medical and public health interventions. Of course, no one knows for sure whether an evil genius will someday overcome the world's defenses and loose a plague upon the world for fun, vengeance, or a sacred cause. But journalistic habits and the availability and negativity biases inflate the odds, which is why I have taken Sir Martin up on his bet. By the time you read this, you may know who has won. Some of the threats to humanity are fanciful or infinitesimal. But one is real: nuclear war. The world has more than 10,000 nuclear weapons distributed among 9 countries. Many are mounted on missiles or loaded in bombers and can be delivered within hours or less to thousands of targets. Each is designed to cause stupendous destruction. A single one could destroy a city, and collectively they could kill hundreds of millions of people by blast, heat, radiation, and radioactive fallout. If India and Pakistan went to war and detonated 100 of their weapons, 20 million people could be killed right away, and soot from the firestorms could spread through the atmosphere, devastate the ozone layer, and cool the planet for more than a decade, which in turn would slash food production and starve more than 1 billion people. An all-out exchange between the United States and Russia could cool the Earth by 8 degrees Celsius.